that Goldsmiths, University of London, our the institution where we were formed, was willing to put into this work. Happily, after we left, they put a lot more money in, and maybe Vicky will tell you a bit more about that. So I'll just say a little bit about what we have been doing and what else is going on in this space and the things we're thinking about at the moment. So at the moment, the kind of formative guidance in this area focused solely on student-to-student sexual violence and harassment, which Clarissa, I think Vicky, are maybe going to talk about. It didn't mention staff or faculty as perpetrators at all, despite our lobbying them to do so. And so currently there are no national guidelines on how universities should prevent or respond to faculty and staff sexual misconduct. Universities don't have to and probably don't record incidents. And a couple of years ago, The Guardian, one of the UK's national newspapers, did a national freedom of information survey of universities and found that a third of them don't even have a personal relationships or a staff-student relationships policy about whether romantic and sexual relationships, how they're dealt with between staff and students. And of course that's relevant because such relationships can easily become abusive because of the power dynamic and because of the blurred boundaries that they can that can be present. So we've produced three reports so far. The first one in 2018 with the National Union of Students Women's Campaign, and it was really great to see National Union of Students, you know, taking leadership in this space. A survey of 1,800 students, mostly current students, a few former students. And I won't say much about this because you can read the report if you're interested. But yeah, sexualized behavior between staff and students was common. And a lot of this behavior fell into what we would define as sexual misconduct. Interestingly, we also asked about professional boundaries with, and we found that 80% of respondents were uncomfortable with staff and faculty having sexual or romantic relationships with students. So, you know, that's one, I think that's a pretty clear steer for universities to kind of professionalize this area. So following up on that report, I did a qualitative study of students' experiences of attempting to report their institution and analysing policies. And, you know, this really resonates with a lot of what we were hearing this morning. Complaints processes for the 16 interviewees were traumatic, long, lengthy, and ultimately mostly ineffective. Things have started to change since 2018 because all of those interviewees were people who had reported in the 5 to 10 years previous to that. So we're hoping that we would see a bit of a shift around this. And so really my current interests are focusing around complaints processes and how these work or don't work. So the third report that we produced just this March has come out, so it still feels quite new, is recommendations for how complaints processes should work. Because one of the things we found once we started looking into why they were working so badly was that in fact student complainants had fewer rights in the process than staff respondents. And so as we've argued in the report, in a society where vastly more sexual misconduct complaints are made by women against men than vice versa, when the process is giving more rights to the respondents, which the staff-student process does at the moment, then that places women at a particular disadvantage, and so is a breach of the Equality Act. And I should say we produced this in partnership with Georgina Calvert-Lee from McAllister Olivarius, and you can see the members of the 7052 group who were involved in this report, and Tiffany Page is joining the workshop this week as well. So I'll say a little bit about the kinds of issues that came up in our sector guidance, and already from the conversation this morning I've got things that I would now want to change, or at least query in relation to some of the issues we talked about. And so we should have got in touch with you a year or two ago when we were developing this. But it is a work in progress. We produced the consultation document in 2018, consulted with the sector. We produced this version this year. I'm sure there'll be another version in a year or two, although the thought of it makes my heart sink, but it'll probably be needed. So the key principles are parity for the responding party and the respondent. So really the questions of due process that we were talking about this morning, but how that can work when there's a power imbalance and how that can work in sexual misconduct cases. Because sexual misconduct cases between staff and students in the UK tend to be the National Complaints Guidance, which is from the Ombuds Organisation for Student Complaints, It suggests that student complaints towards staff go through the staff disciplinary process. So the student makes a complaint, then it goes straight into the HR process as soon as the complaint is deemed to be worth investigating. So students get caught up in this HR process and the staff disciplinary process, in which they are witnesses. They don't have rights as complainants in this process. So we argue that there should be parity between staff and students in relation to all of these areas, and this will all be familiar to many of you who've worked in this area, and I won't go into this in detail. But some of the issues that have come up that we're still working on are outcomes, sharing outcomes with complainants. And I asked a question about that this morning, and it was really interesting to hear that the responding party, if the complaint is upheld, I think Aisha said that the name of the responding party is made public, and then there's a kind of and there's also an opportunity to hear, not hear details about cases, but to hear, to kind of discuss what's going on. There's a much more kind of public accountability system, and well, there was under the JS Cash system. Whereas this is a battle we are fighting, and the Equality and Human Rights Commission here in the UK, which is a non-departmental government body funded by the government but independent of the government, it's just produced some really helpful guidance on sexual harassment, which is about which suggests that the complainant should be told what action has been taken to address their complaint. Now, it probably doesn't sound like progress to those of you in India who who have been used to a more progressive system, but this is progress in the UK context. My interviewees in the Silence of Students report would get told if their complaint was upheld, but they wouldn't get told anything else. So, you go through a 1 year, 2 year complaints process, you get a letter saying, your complaint was upheld, thank you very much, go away, effectively. So this is one of the actions that we're pushing towards. Another issue that we're talking about, and again, this came up briefly this morning, was about what about when the complainant doesn't want to come forward. And there are obviously very good reasons why complainants don't come forward. It's probably dangerous for them in a lot of instances. There's a lot of risks for them. So we have produced a briefing suggesting that higher education should act proactively if they are aware of complaints, if there are rumours or if there are disclosures that indicate a safeguarding risk. This does not mean forcing the complainant to make a complaint. That's obviously takes away control and choice from the complainant, but there are other actions that they can take. Similarly, UCL, and Vicky might say a bit about this in a minute, have been starting environmental investigations, which is very similar to what we're suggesting here. So, great minds coming from different directions have come to the same conclusion. Other points we discuss in the guidance, should alumni complaints against current staff be investigated? Yes, they should. Sneak preview. Safeguarding risk assessments. We know that staff and faculty perpetrators are likely to be serial perpetrators. So actually we have to assume when a disclosure is received that there are other students and staff who are also being targeted. So how do we ensure safety for other people in the university community? Questions about anonymous testimony. This is a really common one. I'm sure you'll be aware if a staff member resigns during an investigation. And then we're also thinking about remedies about how complaints. How can you involve the wider department, the wider discipline in thinking about restoring trust in the institution. There's other work going on nationally. So, I mean, I have talked predominantly about our work, but Universities UK, which is a lobby group for universities, but they have led a lot of the work in this area. I've been sitting on a committee for a couple of years to try and produce some guidance in this area. Universities Colleges Union are currently convening a committee to do some campaigning work on this nationally, and crucially they are addressing their own internal complaints processes within the union. Unfortunately in the UK the staff union is part of the problem, but we're hoping to change that. And then the new regulator, the statutory body in England and Wales, is having a consultation on upholding this. And as I mentioned, UCL is doing some really progressive work around their new personal relationships policy and their environmental reporting and various other bits and pieces. And Clarissa will talk about some of her fantastic work at Durham. So I think I managed to do that in 10 minutes. Please do tweet us with our contact email, but also you're welcome to email my personal email if you want to follow up. And I look forward to speaking more with you all tomorrow and later. Oops. Did Do I stop sharing?
Thank you so much, Anna. You had like about 30 seconds remaining.
Oh.
Amazing. Thank you so much. That was really, really insightful. And maybe we will have time later to kind of flesh out a little bit of the role of HR, which Vrinda brought up in her talk as well. And also it's an experience that we've had in dealing with cases through Account for This. So maybe it would be very interesting to flesh a little bit of that out later in our questions and answers. But now I'm going to pass it on to our next speaker, who is Vicky Boris. Over to you.
Thank you very much.
Give you a message when you have 2 minutes left.
Great. Thank you. And thanks to everyone for speaking and organising today's conference. I was only available for half of the first session, unfortunately, but what I heard was really great, and I'm really looking forward to watching the recording if it's available in parts later on. So I'm focusing today really on student-to-student sexual misconduct, and I've been kind of circulating around this work for about a decade. So I thought it was useful to give some context to where it came from and acknowledge the people who initiated this work, because we're doing lots of great things these days, but I think it's useful to track back to 2010. So starting there, I guess, actually, let me give an introduction to myself first, and then I'll start back at 2010. So as I've been introduced, I'm the Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Manager at UCL. So I have a quite broad remit currently. I work with our School and Life of Medical Sciences. I also run a positive action program for Black, Asian and minority ethnic staff that is called Inclusive Advocacy. And it's a sponsorship program where we pair senior staff with middle managers to try and accelerate them in their careers and help sort of dismantle racialized barriers in the workplace. Recently I've started working again on this bullying, harassment, sexual misconduct work. So some of you may know my predecessor Kelsey, who did an amazing job at UCL for the last 2 years, really kind of pushed the ball in the right direction and has left me in really good stead to carry on with that work that she started. And then prior to being UCL, I was leading this work at Goldsmiths for a couple of years, but it was only a fixed term role, unfortunately. So that came to an end. But I'd like to track back to 2010 when NUS produced the Hidden Marks research. So I was working at NUS at the time, and that research was the first of its kind, and it was a sort of analysis of the experiences around harassment and sexual violence that women students specifically were facing on campus. And that found that 68% of women had experienced some kind of verbal or non-verbal harassment in and around their institution. Off the back of that, students' unions got really active and started launching their Zero Tolerance to Sexual Harassment campaigns. Now, these campaigns came out of making students' union spaces safer. They were very much designed for a licensed venue. And unfortunately, universities kind of unhelpfully co-opted the language of zero tolerance at a time when there was clearly a lot of tolerance going on of cultures of sexual violence. And that was one of the big criticisms that hit universities. You can't really just stick a phrase of zero tolerance in there and not do anything about the problem. And those problems range from sexist comments right through to assault, and universities was just not responding to or equipped to deal with them. Around this time, I think we're about 2013 by this point, and NUS commissioned Professor Alison Phipps from Sussex and Isabel Young to undertake some research into something called lag culture. Now, the phrase became unpopular quite quickly, I guess, because it's sort of personified who was the problem, but what the report really did do is it produced a lot of dialogue and statistics that actually started to gather some traction and interest with the press, and I think this is often kind of forgotten about, but there was a big lad culture audit and that was the process that discovered the issues around the Zellick guidelines. So lots of universities started looking at what the Zellick guidelines were, and effectively they stopped universities from investigating things that could constitute a criminal offence. They were written in the 90s, and universities had the reaction when they were told about these things, if you don't report it to the police, there's nothing we can do about it. And I probably need to go into another 15 minutes as to why making people report to the police in order to resolve these things is a problem, but that put a lot of survivors off from coming forward, even if the behaviour that they were experiencing wasn't a criminal offence, but it was along that spectrum of sexual violence. So in 2015, The Guardian took a lot of interest and started actively asking students in the UK to start sharing their stories of assault that they'd experienced at universities. And that's about the time that the UK Task Force was set up and the Change in Culture report was released 2 years later. And the people who came forward, the student unions who led these campaigns, are really the people who sort of led the charge to really see change happen. But where are we in 2020 is the question I think that is at hand now. So the reports came out and we've seen quite a swathe of universities getting new policies and processes, getting training, getting reporting platforms, and all of this work has been kind of plentiful, but it's been very inconsistent, and I'll come back to a bit more of the problems around the inconsistencies. So coming back to the kinds of policies and processes, like Anna already mentioned, one of the big policy changes that we've made at UCL is around notifying the reporting party of the outcome. It's a decision that was enshrined in our new policies. It isn't common practice amongst all universities, and it can leave the reporting party really in the dark about what's happened after they've reported, and it can really allow further disempower someone who has already had power taken away from them through an act of abuse. We also, as Anne's mentioned, have environmental investigations. So these can be initiated through problematic cultures or anonymous reports that we might receive, and can be initiated as a look into a particular area, usually a department. And as a result of that, individuals may be identified to be, and it might trigger a disciplinary process, but it's not focused, the actual environmental investigation isn't focused on finding like problematic individuals, but about assessing the way in which culture exists in a certain environment and what can be done proactively to change that. Then in terms of training, like lots of universities have been getting specialist training with sexual violence, domestic violence organisations, and lots of them have been developing different formats of bystander training. Coventry have an open source version of that, which is pretty good. And lots of people, it was very popular for a while to do consent training. I think that's evolved quite a lot to be more about a broader spectrum of, sort of skills and knowledge and responsibilities. And they're usually packaged within a broader training package rather than single sort of I Heart Consent campaigns, which seem to be getting less popular. And people are now thinking of these as sort of more longitudinal pieces of engagement. And then also reporting platforms have been something that has been utilised by students. Now at UCL, we've not found that students have used it as much as our staff, but that's different in other universities. And some people have just created their own internal platforms. We use Report and Support hosted by Culture Shift, but these have been sort of the main kind of, I'd say, swells of activity that have been happening and as a result of all of the work that's been led. We also hosted a conference recently, Calling Time on Sexual Misconduct at UCL. Many of you attended, and it was really inspirational to be able to listen to and hear from people from all over the globe about how they are responding to and preventing sexual violence from happening in their universities. So, I mean, I think my reflection is that universities are in a better position than they've ever been. Student services are better equipped to support those who've experienced sexual misconduct. Universities are encouraging people to report. There have been more investigations. However, we don't really have a solid sort of estimate or record of who is doing these things, how they're doing them. There's a real, like I've said, lack of consistency amongst universities. And obviously with the Office for Students, we're doing a consultation and thinking about regulation, but that's been paused. And I think that that was starting to address the issue of the fact that it's currently a bit of a lottery, depending on which university you go to, how well you might be supported if you experience these things, or how likely you are to experience these things, because some universities are actually getting to the crux of prevention work and trying to change those cultures. And it shouldn't be that just because you apply to a particular university, you're more likely to experience sexual violence. That isn't acceptable, and definitely I think more now. The other thing I'd say is that climate surveys are not very common in the UK, and we we have a sense of the problem because of some like initial research that was done, but there hasn't been large cohort research done to the same extent at each university. You know, I think people have there's been a few things like the revolt research, the 1752 groups research, but we've not seen the numbers that some other national centre research has done, and it would be really helpful to really fully understand the ways in which people are experiencing these things. So I guess I just want to move on to my final thoughts on this, and I guess that's in relation to thinking about moving forward into the coming year and the fact that we're living through a global pandemic right now and the challenges that that presents universities for supporting students who are experiencing sexual violence. At least at the beginning of the year, many students are going to be studying in country. How do we support those students remotely? What services are available to them, and how are they available to them? When are they available to them? We know each year that many prospective students are finally able to leave abusive situations through accessing education, through going to university. And with these uncertain times and with restrictions on freedom of movement, we may be seeing those doors closed for some of our survivors who usually would be coming to university in September. And that saddens me greatly. Universities really need to consider how sexual violence might manifest in a remote campus. And we're expecting a lot more online issues, and we need to be ready for those. And I think that's the challenge that we face basically going into the next academic year. So thanks.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Vicky, for all the insights and for flagging so many important issues. And I think, again, like, you know, the issue of online harassment is something that we should definitely talk about, because we are in a completely new environment right now, and we're all learning how to adapt to these changes. I've also been posting some of the reports that Vicky has been talking about, but also the reports by 1752 Group. So feel free to look at the chat and access those reports. These are really important sources. And on that note, I'm going to pass it on to Clarissa, who's our next speaker. Over to you, Clarissa. I'll send you a reminder when with 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me today. So again, I'm Clarissa Humphreys. I work at Durham University as the Sexual Misconduct Prevention and Response Manager, and I'm also the co-author of the new book, Addressing Student Sexual Violence in Higher Education, A Good Practice Guide, with my co-author, Professor Graham Towell. So I'm going to share my screen, just to make sure this is working for us today. Hopefully you can see that now. And I'm just skipping right ahead. Okay, so there's my screen. I am going to talk mostly today about the book as a new resource for practitioners, activists, and leaders, policymakers, you name it. And this, you know, part of this is from my experience and work at Durham University, and then there's also things contained in this book that are separate from Durham, but are more about good practice seen on a national and international level as well. And so I'll spend just a few minutes today talking about kind of the purpose of the book and the contents, and highlighting some key principles and points that we make in the book. But what I do want to say is, if anybody is interested in the book, that all of the royalties for this book go directly back to the Rape and Sexual Abuse Counseling Center for Durham and County, for Darlington and County Durham. And so we were very certain that, you know, the proceeds for this book, we want them to go back to supporting survivors. We want to ensure that survivors are going to benefit from this book, not only hopefully with universities potentially improving practice, but also just financially from the book itself. And at the end of my talk, and I also have sent a flyer through, is a promo code for the book. So it's paperback, it's $19.99. It's got a 30% off promo code that brings it down to $12.99, or if it's an ebook, for $10.99, I think on Amazon and a few other places. So we've tried to make it as accessible as possible, trying to make it in a cost range that would hopefully be accessible, and also that universities would be happy to buy for their libraries, so students and staff could access them in that way as well. So we're hoping that, although it's not a free resource, it, in terms of a book, is a fairly reasonably priced resource for what it is. So a little bit about the book. It's the point of the book is actually to start kind of in the here and now and help universities move forward their practice or start their practice in this area. And so it's set up in two parts. There is a why section, which is part one, and part two is the how section. And essentially part one is the business case. So if you are a student activist, if you are a practitioner, if you're an academic, if you're trying to get your university to pick this up and start resourcing it and actually doing this work, part one is setting out some of those arguments from, you know, the impact on survivors, the impact on the university, the financial risk, the legal risk, you know, the risk to losing students entering your institution, you know, all of those things are kind of highlighted in part one. And that's the point of that is so that we kind of all know that we need to do this work, but being able to articulate the reasons why in a way that executive leaders in our institutions will think, oh, I need to do that. It's kind of setting those out as well, because I think for a lot of us working in this area who care about this, who've been doing activism in this area for maybe years or decades, we might have a moral reason we want this work to go forward. We might see the impact on ourselves, on our friends, on the people we work with, on our students. But being able to articulate in a way that is going to make university executives go, maybe this is something that's going to impact our business, and kind of pushing it in that direction. And part of that kind of way of arguing it and to getting people on board is, I think, very much a here and now moment, because ideally we wouldn't want to have to say, well, you know, there is a legal risk if you don't protect your students. There is a legal risk if you don't protect your staff. You'd like people to be able to just pick this up and recognize it for what it is and do the work. But in the moment where we are now, we recognize that sometimes it actually takes spelling out even the financial reason why universities should do this work. And so having that already set in place in the book is something that we want to be a resource to those who are picking this up. Then the section two is all of the how. And as Vicky has really helpfully explained the kind of timeline of events in the UK, when we got to 2016, we had enough evidence there to say this was a problem in universities, thanks to the work of the NUS and other academics who were doing this work for over a decade. And then when 2016 came along and Universities UK released their guidance alongside Pinsent Mason saying, well, actually, this isn't just a police issue. This is a safety issue, this is a human rights issue, this is an equalities issue. You need to be ensuring your students and staff can study and work in environments free of harassment and abuse. So you now need to take this forward in-house alongside with allowing people to go to the police if that's their choice. What we ended up with was a lot of guidance of kind of high level principles of things we should do and that we needed to take on this work. But what I found was lacking was some actual specific concrete examples of tools and resources to do the work. And so it felt like a lot of us were just kind of scrambling and we were making things up as we were going. We were trying to reinvent the wheel and we didn't have a set of tools we could pick up and use in our situation. So you had a lot of resources, staff time, student activist time, coming together, trying to say, well, how are we actually going to do this? And what we wanted to do with this book was give people a starting point of actual those practical tools and resources so that every single university wasn't saying, oh, well, how can we ensure students don't contact each other? What would a no contact arrangement look like? What would a non-contract agreement look like? And we all have different language and we all make it up slightly differently. And it just, you know, was something that actually, here's an example of a no contact arrangement. Here's a no contact order. Here's a no contact agreement. Here's three different versions, the ways in which you can use those different versions, and you can amend those to make sense in your environment. And so that's kind of the idea of what we've done with this book. And so in the in part two, I'll talk to you a little bit about the chapters, but at the very end of the book, we've got an appendix which lays out six resources, and some of those include templates. So that example of a no contact order that I talked about is resource three. There's a template letter there that universities can actually pick up and they can amend that to make sense for their environment, but they've already have the language there to use. They already have the principles there ready to go. And then in the chapters in the book, we're actually explaining, well, what's the difference between a no contact arrangement, agreement, and order, and when can you use which, and how would you need to shift that language? So they've got a template example there. Now they have three different versions to work with, and one institution can use all three depending on what needs to happen in that situation. A no contact order is a sanction. A no contact arrangement is a precautionary measure. A no contact agreement is a resolution. You've got three different options to use, but the resource is there for you. And so that's kind of that's one example of how we use the book and how we at least hope the book can be a resource to universities, is kind of bringing in some consistency around language, around practice, but also doing it from an evidence-based point of view. Some of the other resources that are here in the appendix are like the key resource one, which is for survivors and professionals, which particularly is the resources that are listed for survivors are particularly based in the UK, and of all different forms of sexual violence and gender-based violence are listed there. And they're listed by different types of experiences and also by different types of identity. And then there's a section on resources for professionals, and that's where professionals can access more tools and resources, where they can access continuing professional development, where they can access support for themselves as people working in this area. And it's by no means an exhaustive list, but what it is a starting point. So people can start accessing some of these, so when we're signposting people to support in a non-directive way, we're saying, well, here's some resources that are available. And when we're creating partnerships amongst our institutions, we're partnering with the right organizations who are going to come from this work from a point of view that's going to actually protect our students and staff as well. There's a lot of other things I could say about the resources in the appendix, and I could kind of walk you through all of them, but just for the sake of time, I just wanted to show you that they're there, and then talk to you a little bit about the approach that we actually promote in the book. So the section two, which starts in chapter four, is about embedding a comprehensive institution-wide approach. And this is what we're saying is required in order to do this work effectively and in a safe way for our students and staff. And I keep saying students and staff because the book itself is about student perpetration. So we're talking about addressing student perpetrators. We do not, in this book, discuss staff perpetrators because we need a whole nother book for that one. But the point of the book is addressing student perpetration. But some of the principles and things and resources that we use could apply to both staff and student perpetrators. And this is one of them. The comprehensive institution-wide approach would apply to both. And so what we say in the book is that all six of these elements have to be embedded in a comprehensive institution-wide approach that's then applied at four levels in the institution in order to do this work well. And this is based on the evidence of what we need to be doing in institutions. And the book itself is written from a UK perspective. However, I think one of the things that's really helpful about it, we've got a foreword in by Dr. Perna Sen, who is the executive coordinator on against sexual harassment at UN Women. And in the foreword, she really situates the book from an international perspective. And in her work overseeing the guidance around addressing gender-based violence at universities, she's saying, well, actually, a lot of these principles do apply and would work in other institutions in other countries, recognizing the different legal frameworks that each country will work in. But going back to this institution-wide approach, what we're saying is it has to be trauma-informed. Essentially, you cannot work with individuals who've experienced trauma and provide them with support, run investigations, and run disciplinary processes without an understanding of trauma and understanding how people are going to respond in the moment during an incident, how they're going to respond after an incident, and being able to actually investigate these things and address them appropriately. So the trauma-informed approach is embedded, it's explained throughout the book itself, but also we spend an entire chapter talking about running trauma-informed investigations themselves. We then talk about being survivor-centered and making sure that the survivor is choosing how to take forward what's happened. So if they want to make a report to the university, if they want to make a report to the police, if they want to make a report to both, or if they don't want to make a report to either institution, that that's going to be supported as long as it's legally, as long as we're legally able to. So if someone is a child, then safeguarding legislation comes into play, and we would still try to center that person in the process, but we would be legally required to report that to the police. Whereas if someone's an adult, we're going to allow them to choose how to take that forward and support that choice and make sure that they have an informed choice, that they understand what options they have available to them, that they, if they're thinking about the police, if they're thinking about the university, that they actually understand what those, what that would look like to make a report, what it would look like to go through an investigation, what would actually be asked of them in those processes, rather than making any decisions blindly. We also want assurance, human rights-based and social justice-based, and those are fairly interlinked, but one of the things that I really like to pull out in relation to the social justice-based process is that it cannot be one individual who is doing this work. It actually has to be across the piece, the institution embedded doing this work, because when social justice-based, if you rely on one person, you rely on that person to not burn out, you rely on that person to be competent, you rely on that person to take the weight of all of this on their shoulders, and it won't work. It doesn't actually have a sustaining process. Of course, then it has to be intersectional as well. I think particularly in the UK, a lot of criticism, and rightly so, is having a process that only addresses those individuals who are usually fresher, young, white women who are home students who have had experiences perpetrated against them by men who are, again, cisgender, heterosexual, usually of a higher year, and who are perpetrating in a certain way, usually with alcohol. And so you get this very narrow view of what sexual violence looks like. You get this very, and by that narrow view, what you end up doing is you end up missing out on all the other people who've been impacted, on all the other types of perpetration, and you're actually not creating a safe environment for everyone. And then, of course, it has to have perpetrator accountability. And what we mean by this, which is really important, is that we actually need to ensure that the students recognize there are consequences for that behavior. I think I might be over my time. Sorry, I just noticed the chat, so I have to apologize. I'm going to go ahead and stop there. There's so much more to say, and yet the book itself, I feel like, is still missing so many things because there's a lot to do in this area. But if anyone does have any questions or wants to get in touch, you're welcome to contact me. That's Graham's Twitter account as well. He's also very vocal and happy to answer your questions about the book. But thank you very much for listening. I hope this has been useful.
So much, Clarissa. This has been really useful. And I'm going to hand over finally to Shelza to tell us about a little bit about the work that Account for This has been doing in this space as a group of student activists who were predominantly women of color.
Thank you, Adrija. Today I wanted to begin by acknowledging all students and activists who've been a part of the Account for This campaign. I believe that it's our collective concerns, commitment, and a vision for justice which brought us together and will hopefully keep the campaign alive. So I'll begin by speaking a little bit about how A4T campaign started. In SOAS in 2018, when some of us were master's students there, and at the height of the Me Too campaign internationally and the controversy of the list in India, the usual whisper networks did their thing, and a group of students came to know about several cases of sexual harassment at SOAS. And usually dates are important to archive any struggle, but in this campaign, which is not more than 2 years old, I'll only speak about the events that defined the campaign. So there was anger because of
Shelza.
Sorry.
Hilda, sorry to interrupt you, but your video is frozen. You're back again.
Okay.
But it's fine.
Can you hear me?
Your voice is breaking up. Maybe try to switch off the video and see if it works better.
Okay, sure. Restart that. So just talking about how the campaign started in 2018, at the height of the Me Too campaign internationally and the controversy of the list in India, Whisper Networks did their thing and a group of students came to know about several cases of sexual harassment at SOAS. So there was a lot of anger because of having to deal with sexual harassment on campus, and there was frustration because complaints were being mishandled or dismissed by the complaints manager. There was complete confusion over the ad hoc nature of the complaints mechanism. And all of this sort of led to meetings. And these meetings were between survivors, between complainants, between volunteers who decided to give their time to drafting petitions to the management, to collecting testimonies, making posters, and mobilizing other students. Even today, I would say that the activists of this campaign carry the burden of all the anonymous testimonies that we received, and some of them ranged from, as Anna spoke about, the alumni of the university, and they spoke about how they were, disappointed, and for many years they waited for justice and nothing came about. They were quick to even reach out to an anonymous form and tell us that, you know, this is how they were wronged by the university. So we did the task of collecting anonymous testimonies. And as I said, the activists of this campaign carry that burden because of, you know, having gone through those testimonies. There was general harassment and dismissal faced at the hands of the institution. And there was frustration because of having to start from point zero each time. And it is that, I think, that burden that is and will be, you know, represented through our collective anger and frustration at every forum. We, in this process, have learned that institutional memory is generally evergreen and intergenerational when it comes to those who dissent, but is almost negligible when it comes to dealing with communities and individuals who have faced harm. So when we looked at some of these, when we collected some of these reports, drafted our first petition, which was in the form of a question and answer format, because we sat for months looking at SOAS website, SOAS policies. They were extremely confusing. We didn't have any answers as, you know, just readers, not even survivors of at that point. Some of us were survivors of sexual harassment in the group, but some of us as lawyers couldn't figure out what the policy was trying to say and where on the SOAS website. And when we did the task of putting together the petition, we did it in a mode of, you know, a kind of feminist anger and frustration, and ask them questions. Tell us, and this, you have to be accountable. And that is how the name comes about as well. You have to be accountable for telling us where do we go when we face sexual and gender-based violence in the institution. You have minimum standards of duty of care. We are a community of students. We engage as students, and we expect certain standards. And not in the language, of course, of being consumers of the institution. And at this point, we heard, when face-to-face with different figureheads at SOAS, we heard responses such as, this is a South Asian problem. This was because many of us came from the Indian or Pakistani background who formed a part of the account for this campaign. We heard things like, we have formulated policies around this. You can find it on our website. Never mind the fact that actually, whenever we would ask them, none of them could actually show us where on the website the policies existed. And there were responses from professors of law department saying, how dare you come to my office? I'm going to complain against you. And these were cases that, in all honesty, we took to try and understand what we could do as help. I mean, as students in an international atmosphere, trying to get some semblance of justice. And I'm certain that we all know that these are responses, and they're a tiny reflection of what survivors have to face when they approach any institution to get justice. And we encountered the intricate bureaucracy of the institution, the many figureheads of the unions. It became very clear to us that SOAS's mechanisms were thoroughly disappointing, disempowering, and traumatizing even for survivors in letter and in spirit. Next, what we tried to do was a form of an open, was something called the open forum. And you all heard in the morning the student activist from Pinjathur. This open forum at SOAS was modeled around the Jan Sunwai or people's forums that we have witnessed in and are familiar with in the South Asian context. Taking from what Geeta spoke about, wrote, and what Vrinda said in the morning, just to emphasize that these, the way in which feminist consciousness and learnings also travel with us wherever we may go, and our actions are defined by those, and hopefully they further the agenda of the feminist struggles everywhere. So at this open forum, we invited students, professors, management, the union reps to sit and discuss together. Generally, a hierarchy of communication which is built in institutions through emails, official forms and norms, and well, office walls, was shattered when we asked members of SOAS community to face each other and listen. And yes, our emphasis was on listening to the students, listening to the survivors. For many of us who have seen institutions fail and ignore survivors, this was an affirming process where many survivors chose to share their testimonies and confronted the management on their stale responses in that forum. A line that I'm going to read from our statement sort of informs a statement that we made at the open forum informs the idea of the campaign as well, I think. So it said, this open forum is taking place because many individuals who have passed through SOAS strongly desire to at least shield the next person who experiences sexual and gender-based violence at SOAS, whether this is a student, worker, staff member, or even a visitor to SOAS, from policy and procedural failings. So since then, we have participated in processes of policy drafting that the management has initiated, conducted workshops to grasp the legal and policy landscape in UK, and reach out to more students each year and continue to do some of this mobilizing work around the issue in SOAS. But this is, I think, just not just about our successes or, you know, how far we've come. It is also about the difficult questions we are trying to engage with as activists, survivors, and students. So I'll leave everyone with those, specifying some of those concerns that we have, and they will continue to be discussed and addressed. So I think point one would be, in the context of UK, how do we think about a national framework that reduces ad hocism in dealing with cases of sexual and gender-based violence at the university level? Number two, how do we ensure that cases which involve students in more than one university do not fall through the cracks? And we've seen quite a few instances of universities not cooperating with each other when the perpetrators belongs to some other university and there has been a case. Number three, how do we bring attention to the fact that halls of residence are actually a crucial site where cases of sexual and gender-based violence may be rampant, but most universities neither have knowledge or nor the desire or capacity to even account for these cases. So that's one major problem in our understanding. And fourthly, I think, how do we ensure that demanding our rights, and this is something that is coming from feminist activism and speaking to everybody that we have done in the past 2 years, is that how do we ensure that demanding our rights does not lead to policies that propagate further paternalistic or patriarchal attitudes of the management in universities? How do we ensure that our sexual freedoms and bodily integrity is not subjected to institutional standards of surveillance and control? And I think We've all spoken from that perspective today, but and as I said in the beginning as well, it's all of the participants and the panelists' work that informs whatever we are doing in these spaces and institutions. And this, I think, for me is at the for me and Account for This is at the central at the center of what we are trying to do. That it should no amount of measure should lead to no amount of change should lead to any kind of further restrictions or surveillance on the body. And so I think we all learned in feminist and student struggles that wherever we go, the process of accountability does not end. It is a constant process of pushing the boundaries to dismantle patriarchy, to end gendered violence, and to achieve a world with many more possibilities. Our inherent distrust of institutions as students and feminists tells us that there is no policy or law that managements can actually put together which will not require overseeing by progressive people, collectives, and non-institutionalized communities. I think I'll end there. Hopefully the sessions tomorrow will help us get to these questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shelza, for bringing up all these really valuable questions. And I think you should take them to your group as well. And I'm sure everyone here would be really interested in knowing some of the discussions and critiques based on those points. Thank you to all our speakers for these very insightful talks. I would now move on to questions. This is slightly chaotic because now I have put in so much security that I can't copy paste my own questions. So I have to go through the chat looking for them. But I think I will start with Anna. And there is a question about, can you say a little more about the roles of the unions in obviously in case of staff student harassment, it then becomes the UCU who's dealing with it. But can you talk us through a little more about that?
Yeah, and maybe Vicky might have things to say as well. So we have had fairly extensive discussions with the staff, it's the academic staff union, which is national. They have local branches. Now the issue here is they're supposed to represent all staff who are members who are involved in grievance or disciplinary processes. At least they primarily represent perpetrators, and we don't think that they, as far as we can tell, represent perpetrators or whether they also represent complainants, because there's a power imbalance between staff and students. So I should add that graduate students or PhD students can be members of the university and college union. But even staff-to-staff cases, it's hard to find out if they're ever supporting complainants. So the fact that they haven't flagged this up as a problem previously, and that, you know, we simply don't know, but what we know from people who contact us to tell us about their cases is a typical example might be a junior precariously employed staff member gets in touch with the union and asks for representation in a sexual harassment case. Her email gets ignored or forgotten because the harasser is senior in the union or the harasser's buddy is senior in the union, and so she gets no representation. And then, even worse, the union, the harasser or their representative know the union processes very well. They know how complaints work, so they can absolutely work the complaints process to make sure that actually the harasser gets scot-free and the out of repercussions having made a complaint. So that's what happens in the process, but that's part of a wider set of issues. So they don't support postgraduate students, and postgraduate students also don't tend to go to the student union for support, so they're kind of lost in the middle. They'll only support postgraduate students if it's in relation to the to their teaching within the university, not in relation to their role as students. but more generally the union is male dominated, particularly some branches vary greatly in their politics, you know, in their kind of how male dominated they are. And we've also seen them really make huge concerted efforts to block progressive change within institutions. So they won't allow anything to go forward, which makes it easier for staff members to lose their job. And it's very, 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 very hard to get a staff member to lose their job for sexual harassment. I know of one, perhaps two cases in the UK where this has happened, despite evidence of, you know, multiple complainants, really, really, you know, egregious and appalling complaints and, you know, huge amounts of evidence. Now that's, you know, that's obviously, you know, people's employment should be protected, but we need to have a conversation about how to balance these issues. So in a nutshell, that's my rant about UCU. I don't know if you want to add anything, Vicky.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've had varying experiences with, it depends on the member that you speak to. I had a very supportive UCU colleagues at Goldsmiths who were amazing and helped me co-write policies. But yeah, there are also challenges that universities face where we do at UCL, where we have different processes for certain grades and certain academic profiles, depending, and it's much harder to go through disciplinary if you are in one of the more protected academic roles. And that's one of our big challenges, and there is real resistance to even having conversations about that as well, let alone changing it. And so, yeah, I think that it's really exciting that national UCU might address some of these issues and that they might not have to be individually negotiated with each branch.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Anna and Vicky. And I know UCU is putting together a sexual harassment task force. So that is great news. But one of the reasons why, in account for this, we took the stand for having one policy document which covers student, staff, workers, within the university was primarily for the reason that, you know, Anna, you were just talking about, because we saw, and Shelza can elaborate on that as well, that we consistently saw people being tossed from like one place to another saying that, oh, we are not the first people who are dealing with your case because you're a staff, or we are not dealing with your case because you're a student. And obviously the workers' narratives, because they are so low in the range of power dynamics within the university, they get completely lost. So this is something that we have done, is that we are at the point, so like we campaigned for 2 years and we are at the point where we are negotiating with the management. And one of the things that we had was, we will only come to the table if we have representations from every stakeholder within the university, and we have the promise of one policy document. And the first thing that they told us was that it doesn't work. And when they told us, we said, well, it does. Here is the GS cash model. Read the suction report. So this is something that we kind of framed our campaigning around as well. I'm going to go to the next question, which was for Vicky. But I think, Vicky, you've already answered that in the chat. So I'm going to skip that. So that was around climate studies and if they exist and if they are intersectional or not. There is a question, and I think all our attendees can take that. And what was the, I mean, I'm sure like you don't need to talk about the exact nature of the cases and views, but like what are the kind of testimonies given to university? That was for Shelza. That what happened to the testimonies? Were they given to the university or to the police? If not, why were the testimonies not taken up by the police, university, media, or were they anonymous testimonies? So if you could talk a little more about the anonymous testimonies. And we have a very similar question for Anna, if I can find it. Okay, so what are some of the experiences of sexual harassment complaints in the last few years? So again, like, please don't go into details, but or as much details as you want to go into. How was it dealt with, and did the survivors actually feel safe to share their testimonies? And the last part, yeah. So I think we'll take that, the two questions of testimonies that we've got. So Shelza, do you want to start?
So some of the testimonies, so the testimonies were received on the condition that they will be kept anonymous. and that as an activist group, we may not be able to follow up in individual cases because we received more than 20 cases and they went back to many years as well. The nature of the cases varied quite significantly. I think there was obviously in terms of police case where it was flagged to us that there was a need for a police complaint. We tried our best to again, a learning from the Indian scenario is that it is expected and provided for within the frameworks that where people have to make FIR complaints to the police, they will be escorted or they will be provided help by the committees established within the university, and that that'll be by students or friends, and their support persons will always be available in all kinds of forums. Now, just in terms of following up on those testimonies, I have to admit that because of the nature of the university setup within UK, where students come and go for 10 months, with master's degrees, it may not have been possible, and that was not the intention to begin with, to resolve any of the cases. The intention was always, as was clear while collecting the testimonies as well, that we want to ensure and ask the management questions about, because the management are the first few instances where we approached the management, they putting it very blatantly, they lied to us. They said, or their FOIs, that is the Freedom of Information reports, said that there are no cases of sexual harassment in our universities. We deal with them in this manner. And that is a particular function of how questions are framed, how they answer, how they keep their precedents within the university, all of that system. And so to have a sort of narrative in our hand that, here, these are the cases, they go back to many years, these are the extent of and nature of the cases that have happened within the university, here are the anonymous testimonies from many survivors, and you have to be accountable and answerable to all of these these people. And in our open forum as well, the first condition that we put forward in our statement was, you need to apologize to all the survivors. You need to build a mechanism to follow up with all the survivors. Many things happened where the management never actually got back to us on the testimonies. There were individual sort of, individuals within the management posting the account for this campaigners and telling them, oh, we are very sorry about all the testimonies, but we never saw an institutional apology or even an acknowledgement. As I said, the institutional memory in terms of people who have been harmed by their actions is absolutely negligible. They do not even acknowledge any existence of complaints or grievances of this nature. So I hope I've answered that question. And if you have, the person who's written the question has any specific concerns and specific follow-up to do with Account for This or any of us individually, you are more than welcome to do that. And we will try to address your questions and concerns in a platform which is not public, if you'd like that. I hope that helps.
Sorry, Anna, I just wanted to say that I have shared the testimony link on the chat. So if anybody wants to read the testimonies, which we have consent to share publicly, it's there on the chat right now. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, Clarissa might be able to say more about student-to-student cases in a minute. But for the staff-to-student cases, there's quite a fair amount of detail, obviously anonymised in the report Silencing Students, which is on our website and Adrija's put in the chat box. And this was just interviews with 16 students. I'm doing another set of interviews at the moment. One of the things that we found that is absent from most policies and that needs to be discussed more is what some interviewees called grooming. So being groomed by a member of staff who's in a more powerful position. And this could include behaviours that were actually perfectly, seen as perfectly acceptable and normal. But so going for coffee off campus, giving your present of a book that's helpful for your studies. These kinds of behaviours might be perfectly innocuous, but they would form a pattern of behaviour which were about breaking down the boundaries between the student and staff and moving towards more personal and sometimes sexualized, eventually sexualized interactions. And students found this process really incredibly disempowering, to say the least, and distressing. And they didn't notice what was happening for the most part while it was happening, other than they felt uncomfortable. And then looking back, they were able to see that there had been a pattern. This might also involve kind of social media or online messaging. So that was about half of the interviews experienced some form of grooming, and this might lead to forms of sexual assault or abusive relationships, or just the grooming on itself, we argue needs to be seen as a form of sexual misconduct. The report goes into detail about about other types of sexual misconduct experience. So yeah, abusive relationships, assault, sexual harassment, a range of things. I mean, one thing we don't know that much about yet is to what extent the power imbalance between students and staff creates how this creates a conducive context for abusive relationships if staff and students do get into a sexual or romantic relationship. In terms of the complaints, the litany of what went wrong is pretty long, and that's why we produced the guidance to kind of address quite a few of the issues. Institutions didn't have a process, the process was divided between the student process and the staff process. People who dealt with complaints didn't understand sexual violence at all, didn't have any training or experience in this. One student tried to disclose to about 10 different people on her campus before she found someone who would actually take action on her complaint. Clarissa and Vicky, in your institutions, there's now really, really clear, straightforward mechanisms for reporting. But I would say there's a lot of institutions in the UK where that's still not the case. And more generally, the power imbalance in the relationship between staff and student itself entered into the complaints process. Students had often very little power in the complaints processes. They dragged on for months and months, if not years. They got very complicated, and there were often unclear outcomes or no outcome. And when we're saying we need outcomes to be shared, it's not just your complaint was upheld. We need also if there was any disciplinary action taken against the staff member, which even at UCL they're not doing yet, although I know that you're hoping to. Also, any action taken in the wider institution. So, what I heard this morning about GCash having a process of talking, creating discussion through complaints processes, creating a community dialogue, that's really, really inspiring. And I would love to try and make that happen in the UK. Maybe Clarissa, you can say a little bit more about the types of student complaints you see.
Yeah, I think that across the piece, what we're really talking about is gender-based violence. I think that in the UK, particularly in England, and we've been using the term sexual violence because that's the term that was really promoted in previous work, and that's the term that Universities UK initially addressed. And even in that term of sexual violence, you have a whole continuum of behaviors that are forms of misconduct, some that are misconduct in a policy sense, and some that are misconduct in a policy sense with an institution, but also could be criminal offenses. But what we're actually seeing, which is I don't think is any surprise to anyone. It's just that the language has to catch up, and the way we address things needs to catch up, is all forms of gender-based violence. I think students, particularly in my experience, tend to make formal reports around things that could be criminal offenses. So we see things in relation to serious sexual offenses, image-based sexual abuse, domestic abuse as well. A lot of the types of sexual misconduct that happen that don't necessarily look like a criminal offense but are clearly unsafe, inappropriate, not okay, tend to not get reported because a lot of students will see it as not serious enough to report, or they don't know if they'll be taken seriously to begin with. And so I think from the student to student scenario, you have a lot of people kind of dismissing or minimizing their own experiences because they don't see it recognized in law, and so therefore they don't think that the university will also address those issues. But and that's one of the things around breaking down those barriers. That's one of the things about educating and also creating space for people to report things that may not be so serious that an option to report to the police is available, but are still not okay within our own communities and institutions. And I think that that is a lot of things that we address through active bystander education as well. We try not to just fixate on things that could be criminal offenses, but also to talk about all of those behaviors on the continuum that rise up and allow perpetrators to push those boundaries and perpetrate at the criminal offense level, but actually to say, none of this is okay, which then is a sign to potential perpetrators that, hey, if I can't get away with calling someone the C word, I probably can't get away with touching them inappropriately either. You know, so you're breaking down those barriers at that front level. But from talking to students through training and campaign work and the work that I do with our own students union, all of that is incredibly prevalent and pervasive in our communities, but it's just not being reported. What we're getting as reports are those things that could also be deemed criminal offenses.
Thank you so much, Clarissa. I know we are just like, we're meant to end at 3 because we started late. Is it okay if we take 10 more minutes? Because we have so many other questions. Is that okay with all the other all the panelists? Perfect. Thank you so much. So I have a question which I think Vicky said they wanted to take. So it's a big part of the problem of a lot of drama schools is the culture of visiting lecturers for masterclasses. Often no contracts are signed and people are left alone in classrooms and rehearsal rooms with students. So any models of good practice when it comes to this group? We've seen similar situations with other visiting lecturers or guest lecturers, where the university refuses to take accountability because these people are not quote unquote members of staff of the university. So that is a really good question. And we have one more for Anna, which is, please speak a little bit about what happens once the student or the member of staff leaves the university. This is also a really important question from our context because many of the students and survivors that we dealt with were master students. And so as, or other universities that we knew of, dragged it to a point where they were leaving. But what happens? Have you had any cases or experiences of that?
Yeah, so should I come in on the drama and sort of like, I guess.
Yes, please, Vicky.
Yeah, the key here is, I guess, one-to-one teaching and the challenges that come with that. And there's been some really interesting conversations throughout the conservatoires and similar about methods in which they want to put in touch. And I think it's about like students talking about their comfort levels, having agreements with how they're going to be taught. And the other challenge that we found when we were trying to open up these conversations and really look at cultures when I was at Goldsmiths was we really focused with the music department because they had hundreds of music teachers who are just in like only instructed to work there maybe a couple of hours a week because they teach say the French horn, and we the contracts that we have with them when we were trying to roll out all of our training to those members of staff that told them about how they were supposed to behave and what they should do if someone disclosed to them, and they said, well, we're not going to engage in a half day training or even a 90 minute training because we're only on campus for 2 hours a week. So we had to transition that learning to online. It wasn't the preferable method for teaching that stuff, but we had to find a method to get this out to those people who are like very fractionally contracted. And then similarly, yeah, we had to have a conversation about what's the responsibilities around those fractional contracts because they're not technically the same kind of employee. And I guess what we got from Goldsmiths, and I would hope other institutions would do, is a strong commitment about ending those relationships, whether they were formally contracted or not. So certainly we had one successful case where they refused to invite a guest lecturer, and it didn't have to go through a formal process in that respect because the person wasn't on any kind of pay. They just stopped inviting them. And actually, when it's those sorts of informal relationships, it is a lot easier to respond to, actually, because you haven't got to go through all of the employment legislation work. And this is some careful things about reputational risk and the potential risk, I guess, of having a defamation case come up against you. But if a university really thinks this is serious and is willing to take this as a priority, they will take that blow on the chin, because like they have to think about which risk is more serious. And a defamation case versus someone experiencing sexual violence, I know which one I would pick.
Thank you for that, Vicky. And also just to add, you know, there's a question, you know, Rachel, I know you've done really groundbreaking work in this area around drama schools, but from my work in classical music, because my background is a classical musician, so this culture of power in classical music is one I'm unfortunately far too familiar with. But in my previous research on classical music, my students didn't even label, you know, the kind of bullying, emotional abuse, harassment, they didn't even see it as problematic. They internalized that, thinking it's my fault, I haven't practiced enough, I'm not mature enough, I'm not good enough. It's really exciting to hear about what you managed to push forward at Goldsmiths, and I think I'd love to see, you know, specialist institutions following that, alongside doing that cultural work about making visible those power imbalances, which is much harder. Very briefly about staff members leaving during investigation. I've said something in the chat, but I also, so basically, as far as we can tell, and it's hard to find out because there's so much confidentiality around this in the UK, as far as we can tell, a lot of institutions would finish the investigation. Would not finish the investigation because they would think the problem is solved because the member of staff, you know, the bad apple has left. Some institutions do finish the investigation, and that's really crucial because then if the complainants, usually, let's face it, in staff student cases, it's usually group, or quite often group complainants, a group of people, you know, if they're going to get any redress, any recognition, you know, kind of extra time, you know, compensation, any remedy for what's happened to them, the investigation needs to be completed. So we recommend that happens, and that's something we need to push and make it happen more. But then the big issue that I forgot to mention in the chat is that currently there's no mechanism to share information between one institution and the next. So staff members, passing the perpetrator, the staff member can leave an institution during an investigation and move on somewhere else. And there's a whisper network about sharing. I wonder if this is the same in India, about sharing this information. But the one, you know, one case we know of where a professor tried to share information, or she did share information about an ongoing investigation with a member of staff's new university overseas, and she got sued for libel, and she had to mortgage her house to pay her court fees to defend herself against libel. So there are risks for people in the whisper network who try and take action around this, and it's a really urgent issue. We have raised it with universities HR, who are the HR body of universities. We haven't made any progress on it yet.
Yeah, and can I just come back on the point around accountability? Because I think that absolutely, removing these people from these circumstances is not accountability. It's a very different process. And right now, the best we have is removing people from causing more harm within our institutions. We do not have a fix, I think, for really holding people to account other than our criminal justice system, which we know is inherently flawed in and of itself as well. And so, I sit with that as a problem, and unfortunately don't have a solution to the concept of accountability versus responsibility, which is different. Like, you know, people losing their contracts is not the same as being held to account.
Brilliant. There is a lot of useful conversation going on in this chat, and I feel horrible ending this. I think I, because of security, I had put that no one can archive the chat, but now I wish I had, so that we could save this conversation somewhere and come back to it. But I think we are going to pick up on on so many of the things that we spoke about. It's given us so many things to reflect on how policies should be shaped, on who policies should include, on the involvement of HR, on the importance of grassroots activism to actually hold institutions accountable, on what does long-term cultural change and sensitization look like, that policies need to be trauma-informed, intersectional, and survivor-centered. And I'm sure that we are all going to pick up on these points in our respective groups tomorrow. Tomorrow is going to be a closed-door session. And you've all been emailed your questions and your group information and your Zoom links. So, but if you have any questions, please feel free to write to us. But we will come back for all our open sessions again on day three, where people from these different groups are going to come back and add on to the conversation that we are having today. And we will also have our keynote panel by Dr. Mary Joan and Dr. Navdej Purawal. And also we will end with some music and poetry of resistance. I wanted to say a huge, huge thank you to all our speakers of this panel and also of our morning panel, because we did not have a chance to say a proper thank you and end the morning panel with our reflections. So thank you very, very much for bearing with us, for being patient. This has not been an easy process since morning. So we are truly thankful for all your insights and for sticking with us through all the problems that we've had. And we really hope that we can pick up on the conversation and we can continue it on in a closed door format in day two and in an open door format in day three. So thank you. Have a great rest of the day. This was such a good day. And see you tomorrow, everyone.